This is James Cooper with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District with your Extension Crop Report. Full season soybean planting is not far away, and now is a good time to be thinking about getting fertility set right for soybeans. We might be down a bit in soybean acres from last year because nitrogen prices have fell some, but with the drought that took both the corn and the soybean crops, it's hard to tell where farmers are at in their rotations. A fair amount of wheat was planted though, and it would be a safe bet that most of the wheat fields around here are going to be double crop soybeans in them as well. Soybeans require a lot of nutrients per bushel. A 40 bushel soybean yield would take the same amount of phosphorus as 100 bushels of corn, and the same amount of potassium as 200 bushels of corn. Soybeans have a high quantity of nitrogen and sulfur as well. It's a good thing that soybeans fix nitrogen with their symbiotic rhizobium. It would take around 5 pounds of nitrogen to produce a bushel of soybeans, so a 40 bushel soybean crop would take 200 pounds of nitrogen. However, adding nitrogen to soybean crops has shown to have very little yield response. It often comes down to either they weren't properly inoculated at planting, or some disease or soil issue has stressed the plant to the point that it is no longer supporting its rhizobium nodules. Soybeans are not as responsive to phosphorus as corn, but this is largely because they are grown in warmer soils. Still, soybeans need optimum levels of phosphorus. Generally, soils with 20 to 30 parts per million background phosphorus is ideal. Starter P fertilizers are less effective, except in low background nutrient situations. Potassium, however, is very important for soybeans. They use a lot of potassium, and often, this is the most common nutrient deficiency that I've seen in soybeans. An ideal background for potassium is above 130 parts per million. Fields on the low side, generally less than 100 parts per million, should consider banded fertilizer or a heavy pre-plant incorporation application. Keeping in mind that potassium fertilizer is salt, and soybean seeds are very sensitive to salt. Potassium deficiency is made worse in dry years with a lack of water transport. Despite soybeans' need for phosphorus and potassium, an ideal situation would be for background fertility to be high enough to not need any fertilizer. All phosphorus fertilizer contains nitrogen that soybeans don't need, and potassium fertilizer contains chloride that the soybeans won't respond to. Also, phosphorus-potassium fertilizers are ideally soil-incorporated, which can't be done when no-tilling soybeans into standing wheat stubble. It just makes sense to increase P and K fertilizer before the wheat or corn, with the intent to carry the soybeans next. Soybeans are also fairly sensitive to pH, and phosphorus and potassium availability is going to depend on a balanced pH. Due to acidic subsoils, the ideal pH in this area is between 6.4 and 7, with lime recommendations starting at pHs below 6.2. Sulfur in soybeans is less straightforward, even though soybeans need a lot of sulfur. In sandy soils, or fields without a history of sulfur applications, sulfur can become deficient. But in our clay soils, generally there's enough organic matter turnover and sulfur in the subsoil that soybeans don't respond well to sulfur applications. When it comes to sulfur, it is best to plan for an application before the corn or the wheat that will still be around for the soybeans. Please give me a call if there are any questions about soybean fertility or need some fertilizer recommendations. 620-724-8233. This has been James Cooper with your Extension Crop Report.
Next up, we'll have Wendy Powell, Livestock Production Agent for the Wildcat District.
Hi, this is Wendy Powell, your Livestock Production Agent with the Wildcat Extension District. Fire is an ecosystem driver that facilitates other processes, like the nutrient or water cycle. Fire cannot work alone. The climate and vegetation are partners. Fire is mandatory for the health of prairies, shrublands, and forests. It's a necessary tool for managing wildlife, livestock, and timber. Research shows that while there are many land management tools, there's no substitute for fire. While the outcome to land from a wildfire can be similar to a prescribed fire, they are different. A prescribed fire has clear goals, similar to a doctor writing a prescription for a health condition. A prescribed fire is safely conducted with a trained crew, adequate equipment, and is under specific weather conditions. Prescribed fire can be used to improve forage production, quality, composition, and palatability for livestock or wildlife. Control for non-native plants as well as livestock parasites can be achieved. In forest situations, debris is reduced and sites are prepared for replanting. Fire can be a sound herbicide alternative to reclaim native prairies. All of this with the added benefit of reducing the probability of wildfires. The quality of a pasture or recreational acreage is indicated by the presence or quantity of certain plants. underutilized land may have a large population of eastern red cedar, locust, or elm trees, or other woody species growing unchecked. Acreages that have been overused may only be able to grow plants that have low nutrient values for wildlife or livestock. Wildfires and a few poorly planned intentional fires have received public attention and have been blamed for destroying land. However, research and practical experience clearly demonstrate fire does not destroy land. The real damage done by wildfires is to structures, or in commercial timber production, to the value of potential lumber. Depending on the land manager's objectives, immediate changing results from any fire may either be desirable or undesirable. For example, if a small area in native grass is burned, wild or domestic grazing animals will concentrate their grazing on the burned area, enjoying the fresh new growth that is now easier to access. This is called patch burning, patch grazing, or rotational grazing without fences, which does not reduce livestock production. The growing season after the fire and grazing event may cause the area to be transformed from native tall grasses to native annual forbs that may be labeled as weeds by some. However, this is a short-term phenomenon, and the burned, grazed area will revert back to its pre-burn status under prescribed grazing. The key to successful application of prescribed fire is to use it as part of an overall management plan that considers all of the operation's resources and is directed towards specific management objectives. Only then can fire be used successfully. For more information, give me a call at the Labette County Extension Office, 620-784-5337.
Thanks, Wendy. And now, here's Davin Skrantz, Natural Resource and Diversified Ag Agent, with her report.
This is Davin Skrantz, one of the Agriculture and Natural Resource Agents from the K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District of Crawford, Labette, Montgomery, and Wilson Counties with your K-State Research and Extension report. The Virginia opossum is a medium-sized animal with long, rather coarse fur, a sharp, slender muzzle, prominent, thin, naked ears, short legs all about the same length, and a long, grasping tail covered with scales and few hairs. Opossums are in the family Marsupial, which comes from a Latin word meaning pouch, and refers to the pouch on the belly of the females. Young opossums are born incompletely formed and are carried in this pouch while they continue their growth and development. Although most possums are gray, there are several other color phases. Some are black, some are brown, and a few are even white. Generally, the nose is pink, the eyes are black, and the ears are bluish black. The tail is gray, and the feet and toes are pink to white. Adults range in length from 24 to 34 inches and weigh from 4 to 15 pounds. In Kansas, the breeding season begins about the 1st of February. Gestation takes only 12 to 13 days. The first litter is weaned in May, and the female mates again. The second litter is weaned around mid to late September. The average number of young per litter is 9, varying from 5 to 13. Opossums need watering areas nearby. Although they seem to wander aimlessly, radio transmitter studies indicate that some opossums live their entire lives on as little as 40 acres. Opossums are omnivores, which means they eat a wide variety of foods, including crayfish, frogs, tadpoles, clams, and berries. Generally, opossums do not cause humans much trouble. They live in urban and suburban habitats and sometimes get into basements, attics, sheds, and garages. Often they are injured or killed by automobiles as they cross highways. Opossums are known to host parasites such as mites, ticks, lice, fleas, roundworms, flukes, and tapeworms. They may also spread fungal, bacterial, and viral diseases. Opossums are not aggressive and flee when pursued. A common defense is pretending to be dead or playing possum. The frightened animal rolls over, becomes limp, and shuts its eyes, coming back to life at the first opportunity to escape. From the K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District, this has been a Dave and Strance with your K-State Research and Extension Report.
Thank you, Adavin. And now, here is Jesse Gilmore with his report.
With K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, this is Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's edition of the Hort Report. Mushroom hunting season is starting, and you may feel the itch to get out and find mushrooms of your own. It is very important that you are 100% sure of your identification before eating any mushrooms, and to not eat anything you are completely confident in the identity of. While there are only a handful of plants that could kill you if you ate them, there are many more mushrooms that are potentially fatal. The most common mushrooms beginners look for are morels, oysters, honey mushrooms, and chicken of the woods, as these all have distinctive visual characteristics. Mushrooms grow in forested areas and on forest edges, where the climate stays cooler and more humid, and the mushrooms have decaying organic matter around which to grow. The weather is only beginning to warm up, so right now you will be more likely to find mushrooms on south and west-facing slopes. As the weather gets even warmer, north-facing slopes will also begin growing mushrooms. Be sure to check the rules and regulations of any locations you want to hunt for mushrooms, and always ask permission when wanting to forage on private land. Morels are arguably the most well-known mushroom. Because they are so popular with restaurants, people learn how to identify morels so that they can sell them. The Kansas Department of Agriculture requires harvested mushrooms be inspected for safety by an approved identifier, and offers classes every year that train attendees on how to separate morels from false morels, close lookalikes that have a chemical that is metabolized in your body into a compound that is also used as rocket propellant. Yes, really. Note that this identification class only applies to morels specifically, and harvested mushrooms broadly. Commercially cultivated mushrooms, most of which will be oysters or shiitakes, do not need to go through the same identification class and can be sold with no restrictions. When harvesting, be sure that the place you're harvesting has no restrictions on the commercial use of anything you take. Places that allow foraging for personal use often ban selling wild mushrooms to prevent over-harvesting. Forage sustainably and take only what you need. Chicken of the woods, also known as sulfur shelf, is a very strange mushroom that lives up to its name. It is a shelf fungus, meaning it forms platforms wherever it grows that start orange in the center and turn yellow near the edges. The colors are vibrant, which differentiates them from other shelf fungi like turkey tails, a non-edible lookalike. When cooked, the fungus lives up to its name, having a taste and consistency almost identical to chicken. Reactions have been reported, however, and everybody's bodies are different, so when introducing a new food like a wild mushroom to your diet, it's always best to cook it thoroughly and consume in small amounts at first in order to keep potential adverse reactions to a minimum. For more information on today's topic, contact your local extension office. I can be reached at 620-724-8233 or by email at jr637@ksu.edu. Once again, this has been Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's Hort Report.
Thank you, Jesse, and thank you for listening to K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District Ag Team on KGGF 690 Radio.